that we needed to survive, much less thrive. Prior to Medicaid and really prior to the Americans with Disabilities Act, disabled people were often either forced to live in institutions or forced to stay home behind closed doors because there was no system for us to get our needs met in the community. And Medicaid, combined with the Americans with Disabilities Act, really created the foundation for which disabled people could achieve community integration. With these cuts, once they take effect, disabled people, older adults, disabled children will die. You know, I was born with a developmental disability. I received Medicaid as a child, and I know so many people like me, disabled adults living and thriving now, who were able to get to adulthood because Medicaid existed. I am imagining in this moment so many kids who will not get a chance to make it to adulthood because of these cuts. And I'm imagining so many adults whose lives will be cut short and they will not be able to live into old age because of these cuts. Those numbers are very, very real to disabled people right now.
As a kid with cerebral palsy, you grew up in Louisiana. Can you talk about what happened when Louisiana cut Medicaid, what that meant for your family?
I lost my Medicaid. So I was on a Medicaid waiver, like many kids with disabilities. And through that waiver, I received things like physical therapy in my home. I received support from direct support workers within the care workforce. And my mom received respite. And this allowed her to go back to school to become a nurse and to raise my brothers and I. All three of us have disabilities, really, as a single mom. And when Louisiana decided to basically balance its budget on the backs of poor and disabled people, I had to go through what was called a redetermination. The state had to decide if I was still disabled, even though cerebral palsy is lifelong and never goes away. And they decided that I was too smart to need these services, even though, you know, to this day, I still struggle with mobility. I still need support. I still need support every day. I had assistance getting dressed before I could come to this interview. And we lost all of it. And we fought it. We fought it. We went to a judge and we lost. And today it is harder for little girls with disabilities to get Medicaid supports than it was for me more than 30 years ago. And that should not be the case. As Ijen said, rather than cutting from Medicaid, we should be investing in Medicaid and other systems that support our kids, our families, and our older adults to really live with dignity and thrive in their communities.
I want to go to a testimonial video made during the Medicaid vigil of Brian Coppola, who is legally blind and hard of hearing.
My name is Brian Coppola. I am legally blind and hard of hearing. I rely on Medicaid or MassHelp, as it is Massachusetts' version of it, because I can get transportation to and from doctors and facilities of medical nature due to the fact that I'm legally blind. I also depend on MassHelp to cover essential disability-related expenses, such as hearing aids and any other medical things I may need due to my disabilities, including sometimes eye exams. It would be a disaster to take my Medicaid away from me and put some working requirements in when I need the insurance the most. I cannot afford to be cut off from Medicaid. This is wrong, wrong, wrong.
And this is another testimony recorded for the Medicaid vigil.
Hi, my name is Corey Gilmore. I have a adults with physical developmental disabilities waiver. I currently live in Anchorage, Alaska. Without the support of the staff, I couldn't even get out of bed every day. And everybody who experiences a disability has something to contribute to society. And it is time that people realize we're more than just a problem for society to deal with. We want to contribute. We want to give back to our communities. We volunteer. We speak up when things are wrong, but we also bring solutions to problems. And these Medicaid cuts, you know, they say, oh, they won't affect people with disabilities, but you can't get to the kind of savings that people are talking about without affecting people with disabilities. It just doesn't work. So please, this is our livelihood. This is our life. And our disabilities are not things to be corrected. We came with them.
Maria Towne is president of the American Association of People with Disabilities. Your final comments about what needs to happen right now and why you don't see this is the end of the line, that just these cuts have to be accepted.
Disabled people have always fought for our right to exist. We have had to defend and try to save Medicaid and the American healthcare system multiple times. I know that disabled people are going to keep fighting to cancel these cuts, to repeal this bill, and forcing our nation to respect our lives and provide us with a system where we can thrive.
Maria Towne, President and CEO of the American Association of People with Disabilities, on this month of the 35th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Next up, we go to Arwa Damon, founder of Inara, a nonprofit currently providing medical and mental health care to children in Gaza. Stay with us. For food aid for people in Gaza, singing while occupying the offices of the Senate Majority Leader, Senator John Thune, as they protest the Israeli government's blockade of Gaza. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Hospitals in the Gaza Strip are reporting 7 new deaths due to famine and malnutrition as Israel continues its starvation campaign against the Palestinian territory. Gaza's hunger-related death toll is now at 154, with at least 89 children among the dead. We're joined now by Arwa Damon, award-winning journalist, formerly with CNN, now founder of Inara, a nonprofit currently providing medical and mental health care to children in Gaza. Her new piece for the Atlantic Council is headlined, Inside the Israeli Government's Starvation of Gaza, from an aid group trying to deliver food. She previously spent 18 years at CNN, including as senior international correspondent, joining us from Erla, Turkey. Thanks so much for joining us again, Arwa. Describe what is happening right now in Gaza.
You know, it continues to be indescribable, to be frank. We do have these airdrops that are taking place. We do have what is being described as a trickle of trucks going in, but nothing is happening to actually genuinely stave off the starvation that we're seeing across the Gaza Strip. These airdrops, what we saw of them, for example, in the first 48 hours since Israel allowed them to begin, barely amount to a couple of trucks. What is managing to get into Gaza that is being collected by humanitarian organizations quite often does not make it to the warehouse because organizations are either having to confront armed gangs, and I'll note here that these armed gangs operate in what's known as the red zone, which means that these are areas that are fully under Israeli control, and yet somehow these armed gangs continue to have the capacity to operate there, or the trucks are quite simply swarmed by masses of starving and desperate Gazans. The situation is beyond atrocious. Look, my organization, Inara, managed to recently get its hands on some fresh vegetables. And this isn't produce that came in from the outside. This is locally grown produce in the few greenhouses that are still accessible. And each parcel that we distributed was roughly 13 pounds. So 13 pounds of fresh vegetable cost $120. And I was watching the video sent over by the team, and you would have thought that the children who were grabbing at these vegetables were grabbing at their favorite candy bar. And the joy that was felt by this one family is just so disproportionate. You would have thought that someone had given them the best gift ever. And that just really goes to underscore the level of hunger, of desperation, of struggle that is happening there. And it is quite simply illogical and absurd that the best solution that the world can come up with right now is airdrops and a few dozen trucks, when we're talking about needing hundreds of trucks every single day to begin to reverse the impact that this prolonged hunger and starvation crisis has had on the vast majority of Gaza's 2.1 million residents.
I wanted to get your response to the Israeli ambassador to the U.S. in an interview on CNN with Wolf Blitzer yesterday. His name is Yehiel Leiter. He claimed Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is flooding food into Gaza.
We feel the same way. The prime minister feels the same way, and that's why he's taken every decision possible to have food flood into Gaza. As a matter of fact, right now as we speak, there's 636 trucks, semi-trailers, waiting to enter Gaza, and the UN agencies are not picking them up because of their argument with the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. I appeal to the international community, to the media. I mean, look, there have been pictures that have been broadcast, even on CNN, I got to say this, excuse me. But even on CNN, pictures of children who are suffering from cerebral palsy or cystic fibrosis, not from hunger, and yet we're condemned for it. This has a long history of pointing the finger at the Jewish state and really has to stop.
So that's the Israeli ambassador to the U.S., Yehiel Leiter. Arwa Damon, can you respond?
Yeah, and I'll respond on a couple of points that he made. First of all, on the issue of, you know, U.N. agencies refusing to pick up the trucks. This is not the case. And let me just explain what the process is to actually pick up your cargo once it has been cleared by Israel. And I'll quote a colleague of mine who quite simply put it as, it's not as if you're going to a McDonald's drive-thru. When we want to go and pick up humanitarian aid that has been cleared by Israel, we first have to put in what's known as a movement request. So Israel has to approve our movement, because to go and pick up that aid, we have to go through the red zone. This is not a quick process. Add to that, on the day that you want to actually move, you have to again wait for Israel to give you the green light. You then move to a holding point where you again wait for the green light, and then you're able to move and get whatever it is that you're able to load up onto these trucks. Now, recently over the weekend, for example, there were 15 movement requests that were put through. Half of them were flat out denied. Others were impeded, and only a handful of those 15 movement requests were actually able to go forward. So humanitarian organizations want to go and pick up the aid. We need Israel to facilitate that process and to ensure that that aid is able to be safely picked up. On the issue of the images of, you know, starving children and this claim that they all have underlying chronic or congenital conditions. On the one hand, look, when we're talking about something like hunger and starvation, we're talking right now at this stage about weeks and weeks and weeks where the population of Gaza has gone through very low intake of nutrients and a very low intake of calories. This will first and foremost impact children under the age of 5 whose bodies are still growing, who need those energy stores to be able to keep going. And this results in what is known among children as wasting. So their bodies are quite literally eating themselves up because they don't have enough energy store. And when it comes to children who have underlying chronic and or congenital conditions, yes, they are among the first to also be highly susceptible to dying from malnutrition and starvation because their bodies are already weakened. And so to say, oh, look, this child has cerebral palsy and that's why they died, that is very misleading. Not to mention that a child with cerebral palsy, if they do have access to proper nutrients, proper food, proper medical care, they can actually live to be anywhere between 30 to 70 years old. But I will also point out that it's not the first time that we're hearing Israeli officials deny what we're seeing with our very own eyes. We have also heard this from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu himself, saying there's no starvation in Gaza. We can see what's happening. We talk to our colleagues every single day. My own staff message me saying, quite simply, Arwa, I'm hungry. And so we're at a point right now where, you know, it really feels as if Israel wants us or is trying to convince us that what we're seeing, what we're hearing from the population of Gaza, what we're hearing from Palestinian journalists, what we're hearing from humanitarians and other medical staff on the ground, be they Palestinians or those who are going in on any number of missions, that they're all somehow not seeing what they're actually seeing, and we're not somehow seeing what is playing out on our screens every single day. It's ridiculous.
And, you know, you as a former CNN journalist, they can let the journalists in. There are Palestinian journalists. Many have been killed, but they do not allow in international journalists.
No, they don't. And actually, there was, I think it was yesterday or the day before, BBC and Sky News were taken on an airdrop that was carried out by Jordan, as the BBC was reporting. They were very specifically told not to film out the window. And this call for international journalists to be allowed access to Gaza has been ongoing since the beginning of all of this. And that's not to take away anything from the extraordinary work that Palestinian journalists themselves have been doing. But the sad reality is that if the international media, the outside media, wants to be able to push back against these, frankly, ludicrous Israeli claims, they do need to be allowed to go into Gaza and see it with their own eyes. And I have consistently said, and I said this from the first day I set foot in Gaza over a year ago, that if anyone goes into Gaza within 15 minutes, the vast majority of what Israel is claiming just unravels before your very eyes. And there is a reason why Israel doesn't want to allow journalists into Gaza. And it's not what Israel continuously claims, which are concerns over the journalists' safety, because they didn't even allow journalists, outside journalists, into Gaza during the ceasefire. And it does end up begging the question of, what are you so worried about? What are you afraid that these foreign journalists are going to actually uncover that you are continuing to deny them entry?
Oh, I wanted to turn to a video recorded by your team in Gaza.
Our team went to visit this family. The mother had showed up hysterical and desperate to our clinic. The twins were born in January. They're both running a fever. I mean, just look at the rashes. They have diarrhea, but there aren't enough Pampers. There's not enough water to wash. There's not enough anything. Look at what's left of the baby milk powder. It's barely a couple of scoops. But there isn't any available on the market or anywhere else because Israel has restricted the entry of baby milk powder. The kids are hungry. They haven't showered in ages. Mom shows us how she had to chop off one of her daughter's hair. It was so lice-filled that her scalp was bleeding. Our Inara team is able to provide them with whatever meager supplies that we still have. And one of the boys tells Yusra, our program coordinator, that it's his birthday the next day. And his mother says he asked her for bread on his birthday. Not a cake, just bread. And then do you know what happens? Yusra returns on her own time with this. A bread birthday cake. Because this is the sort of kindness and gentleness and generosity that defines Gaza and how its people look out for each other, whichever way they can.
It's Arwa Damon narrating the piece in Gaza. We last spoke to Arwa just after you got out of Gaza last time in November. Are you allowed back in?
No, I'm not. I attempted to go back in, and I applied to go back in five times in February and March and was finally denied entry with no specific reason that was given. And it's worth noting, though, that the increase in denials of entry to those who are trying to go either on humanitarian missions or on medical missions has increased by 40%. And no one has really ever given a reason why. It's just feels really like another way to sort of continue to suffocate the efforts of humanitarian organizations on the ground. It's absolutely tragic. And I just want to point out, you know, in that clip, because listening to it, especially that ending part, really does make me smile. And I do wish that everyone could, you know, just think that as they're listening to the news, as they're listening to the numbers, so many of those people whose faces they're seeing, they carry the same level of kindness and tenderness that our staff, people like Yusra, do as well.
Arwa Damon, thanks so much for being with us. Founder of Inara, nonprofit currently providing medical and mental health care to children in Gaza. We'll link to your piece for the Atlantic Council, Inside the Israeli Government's Starvation of Gaza, from an aid group trying to deliver food. Next up, we go to the occupied West Bank, where an Israeli settler fatally shot Oda Hadalin, a prominent Palestinian activist. He was 31 years old, who worked on the Oscar-winning film No Other Land. The Israeli settler is under international sanctions, but Trump lifted the U.S. sanctions on him. Stay with us. Kala by Sunny Singh in our Democracy Now! Studio. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. In the occupied West Bank, family and friends of the Palestinian activist and teacher, Oda Mohammed Hadalin, are reeling after an Israeli settler shot and killed him in a village near Hebron on Monday. Hadalin played a key role in the production of the Oscar-winning documentary No Other Land, which follows Palestinians in the community of Masafer Yatta as they struggle to stay on their land amidst violent attacks by Israeli settlers. Residents identified Hadalin's killer as Yinon Levy, an Israeli settler who was put on a European Union sanctions list last year for his violent attacks on Palestinians and property. The Biden administration sanctioned him, but the Trump administration earlier this year lifted the Biden-era sanctions on Levy. Video appears to show him brandishing and firing a handgun at Palestinians ahead of Monday's fatal attack. Oda's cousin and brother-in-law, Ala Hafalin, described what he saw happen.
Yesterday, as always, the occupations continue to attack and ethnic cleansing the Palestinian forces by all the ways. Yesterday, suddenly, the Israel's bulldozers and the settlers were working here in the land of Umm al-Khair. And then they're trying to move the bulldozer from the land to the settlement. And there's a Palestinian, private Palestinian land for us between them. And we tell them peacefully, don't do that. There's so many trees. There's a fence. You will destroy everything. Don't do any of that. Stop. We're trying peacefully to stop them. We call them many times. Stop, stop. And they never hear to us. And they continue until he beat one of my brothers in his head with the bulldozers. And he was in coma. Then after that, he moved and continued. And as you see from here, he destroyed the fence and came here. And the bulldozer is going inside. And the other settlers, Yunon Levy, the very, very well-known settlers, Yunon Levy arrived to the place here. There's no danger for him. There's no one. He was shouting, tell him, why are you doing that? We will call the police. This is not wrong. This is not right. This is what they think that you do. This is a private Palestinian land, according to even to Israel's court. This is a Palestinian land. And they never hear to us. They never listen to us. They continue to do whatever they want. When they arrive here, I was the one who's in front of him. I just filming him, trying to stop him. I tell him, please don't shoot. Don't shoot anyone. There's so many people. There's a children. Stop. And suddenly he's starting shooting a lot of pellets up everywhere. And Oda was inside the center community, far from the event. He even didn't participate in anything. And they shoot Oda. Oda, the peaceful resistance man. Oda is the teachers. Oda is the father of the children. Oda is my cousins. This is my sister's husband. Three sons left without father. Because why? Because Yanon Levy, Trump decided to lift the sanction from him and give him the permission to continue to kill the Palestinians. This is what we see every day. This is what we're suffering every day. This is not from today. 4 years ago, they killed also my uncle, Sheikh Suleiman, by the same way, by the bulldozers run over him. When this will stop, we just want to live in peace, with our dignity, with our freedom, without suffering, with our rights.
That was Oda Hadaline's cousin and brother-in-law, Ala, speaking to Oren Zeev, who joins us now from Tel Aviv. Oren's a reporter and photographer with 972 Magazine and the independent Israeli news site Local Call. Just co-wrote a new piece about Oda with his colleagues, Basil Adra and Yuval Abraham, who are the directors of the Oscar-winning film No Other Land. Our deepest condolences, Oren. You knew Oda. Tell us the latest. This hasn't stopped. The Israeli military raided the funeral tent and arrested more of Oda's family after his death.
Thank you for having me. Yes, you are right. Unfortunately, this tragic incident that, of course, happened because of the backup the settlers on the ground get from the police, from the army, and from the Israeli government, this has continued. Although, in this case, the victim is a Palestinian, the suspect shooter is a settler, a well-known one, as you mentioned, the Israeli authorities, the army, the police, and the settlers continued their campaign against the village. It's important to say that since the war in Gaza began, this community, like many others in the area, have been under constant pressure to leave, harassment, invasions, seizing of land, and other things. But you could imagine that at least while people are mourning the death of Oda, that was really loved among all the community and also by Israeli international activists that came to the village, they did not stop. The opposite. I was there yesterday. The army came very aggressively to the community center, to the place he was killed, the place people were gathering to remember him and order people to leave. They were pushing journalists, family members that are not from this specific village, and activists, people who knew him very well. They forced us out, and even in the entrance to the village, they started to throw stun grenades. And it's important to say, it's not only an attack on the family, on his friends. It's an attempt to prevent us from the journalists to investigate the case. Of course, we had to be there to see this place he was shot, to confirm that he was in the community center. He was not even near the bulldozer of the settlers. Later on at night, the Israeli army raided the village, arresting 8 men, in addition to 5 Palestinians that were arrested during the incident, while the suspect, Yanon Levy, was released to house arrest by the Israeli court. Of course, the Palestinians are processed in the military system, so they would see a judge only in a few days. But I think this is not a coincidence. It's a message to the Palestinians, to the people who stand with them in Umm el-Khair, that despite the tragedy, the settlers and the state are continuing the effort to push the people out. And, you know, even burying him, a very simple thing, the Israeli army is preventing him to be buried in his hometown, in his village. They want him to be buried in a nearby town, despite the fact his family obviously wants to bury him in the place he lived all his life, and he was active there. His friends and colleague told me, and I also knew him personally, that he was the most peaceful man. Every time I came there, I would see him. He'd always host and greet people and make tours there. He was in contact with the media. He was updating me weekly on the harassment, on the campaign of the settlers and the army to force them to leave. And it's a tragedy that it's hard to imagine. You know, Umm el-Khair will not be the same without him.
Oren Zeev, I want to thank you for being with us. We'll continue to follow this and follow the funeral when it takes place. Again, family members have been taken of Oda, but the man who is responsible for his death has been released under house arrest. Oren Zeev, reporter and photographer for 972 Magazine, will link to your new piece about Oda, headlined "The Most Peaceful Person." I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Stats can be hard to understand, but this one isn't. Nearly 1 in 4 people can't afford food in Canada. What does food insecurity look like where you live? Look up your address at foodsecuritynow.ca. That's foodsecuritynow.ca. Join Community Food Centers Canada in making a difference today.
Starting from the week of Monday, May 30th, the Student Union Building is open 7 days a week from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. The sub-building common spaces, along with the bookable spaces, are available for use. Any comments or questions, please go to the Simon Fraser Student Society website at sfss.ca for more information.